Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode, we have my friend Mario Andretti, who's here to tell us about winning the Daytona 500 in 1967, 50 years after Mario's big win on NASCAR's biggest turf. Interesting to hear about how his stock car career got its start. So we actually begin with his 1966 run, debut run with the legendary and mildly crazy Smokey Eunuch, then got into how he became part of Holman Moody's factory Ford program in 1967, also spoke about what it was like to drive those cars, how different they were, and also the unique setup that Mario had to go with in order to be competitive, having to frankly fight against his own team, an Italian-born American who found he wasn't as welcome in the Deep South as he was at Indianapolis in his midget days, sprint days, and otherwise. So just really interesting to hear about what it was like for Mario going down, barnstorming, and winning NASCAR's biggest race on his second try 50 years ago. Also spoke about what happened soon after that race and how more fantastic things began to unfurl for him. Really looking back at 1967 as the year where Mario Andretti, widely regarded as the greatest all-around driver to live, made his name as that person who could step into anything and absolutely dominate. Closed on speaking about being honored this year as not only the 50th winner, but being brought to the event on behalf of NASCAR and being celebrated for that. Really something that he wasn't widely celebrated when it did happen down there, so it's wonderful to hear that they have him back. You can get every new episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on iTunes, your favorite podcast aggregator, and also please join our new Facebook page, the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. All right. Here we go with the man, Mario Andretti.
Hi, Marshall.
Morning, champ. How are you?
Great, great. How about you?
You know, got up early, got my cup of coffee ready, and I'm doing well, brother. I'm doing really, really well. I was hoping we could maybe start in 66 with your first introduction to Daytona with the great Smokey Eunuch. I mean, you must have been, what, 20 or 21 or so? I bet you could write a book about the experience of just being with Smokey on your introduction to Daytona alone.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I mean, in 1967, I was 26. Anyway, that was young in those days, by the way. Nowadays, it's old. Yeah, that was quite the experience, for sure, because it started out with the me going down to Daytona and called Smokey. I said, I'm coming over to the garage, I'd like to, you know, get fitted up in the car. Oh, no, 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 you can't come over. You know, he was afraid that I, you know, obviously I would see some of his secrets and so forth, and he would not allow me to come to the garage. He said, don't worry, it's going to fit, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to make it adjustable and so forth. And, you know, it was really interesting, actually. Do you know that at the garage, the mechanics were only allowed to open the hood just enough to get their head under it.
Really?
So nobody could see. Yeah. It was really interesting the way he operated.
Yeah.
And all the mechanics, I think they had the tip of their nose burnt, you know, on the radiators and so forth.
Well, I mean, but he was one of the sport's great devious minds, but yeah, to your point, I can't imagine it was easy working in and around Smokey, because for someone who is known for all these crazy ideas, half of them possibly even legal, you know, it probably felt like you were part of more of a government operation than a racing operation.
Well, here's the thing. I think he hired me, you know, because I didn't have the experience in a stock car. I had, you know, I had experience on the oval with the GT cars, because I was part of the program, the Le Mans program, so we did some testing there. So the banking was not, you know, anything new to me, but with the car, he was experimenting with setups. They were really, weird, because his philosophy was very different as far as the G-forces.
Yeah.
And the inertia through the corners, and so he was experimenting all that with me, and I'll tell you what, I had a hell of a time hanging on to that car, because it had no cross weight in it at all. That's what I found out later. But I couldn't make any suggestions, you know, like I would tell him, you know, the car is so loose, you know, and he said, "Oh, don't worry about it, just drive it," type of thing. And you know, so like I said, it was really tough because you know, even those days I was pretty finicky about, you know, I had a good feel of a race car,
sure,
regardless what type of car it was. And you know, I had done, you know, so much testing in IndyCar and everything, and so a race car is a race car, you know, I know what they're supposed to feel like. And and he would totally ignore, you know, what I would say. And so it was an interesting experience, to say the least, you know. But but it is what it is. At least it's something that's quite memorable.
And what did you take from that first Daytona 500, Mario? Because it wasn't, unfortunately, it wasn't something where you had instant success. Everything went perfectly. You know, it wasn't exactly a perfect debut for you. But I have to imagine you at least left the event saying, "Got it." You know, okay, I see in these big cars, this is how working in a pack needs to happen, or these are some drivers who are, you know, maybe I can work with more than others. Curious what you took from that first event to bring into 67.
Well, what I took out of it was that I'm thinking, if all these guys that are going by me, if the car feels the same as mine, they're, I mean, they got to be supernatural, you know. So, you know, that's really what I took out of it. And of course, you know, I definitely had a taste of drafting, but I did some of that during practice and whatever, you know. And the car was diabolical, you know, in drafting, as you could imagine. But he just wouldn't do anything about it, you know. It was his his theory, and he went with it, you know. And I had it just just do it. Just that. I never really got any kind of a feel about the stock car and Daytona until the following Cotton Owens gave me a ride in the June Brickyard. I mean, the, what do you call the Brickyard? The 400.
Yeah.
You know, and there I I was teammate with Pearson.
Yep.
And there I was, and Pearson didn't want to drive the Charger because the Charger didn't have it was a kind of ran basically looser than their sedan, you know, Plymouth.
Sure.
I was quicker than him, yeah, if I remember. And what I loved about Cotton Owens was that he was watching me in the banking and so forth, and he was telling me what the car was doing, which is exactly what I was feeling. So that was a breath of fresh air for me. I said, I finally were going in the right direction, and we had the car working pretty good. In fact, but we blew the engine in a race, but I felt that I was competitive. So those were my two experiences before the 67 race.
You're obviously already part of the GT40 Le Mans program run by Holman Moody at that point in 66. How did the conversation come together for you to join their Daytona 500 program? Was that something where you said, "Hey guys, I'd really love to get a better shot at this than I've had," or did they reach out to you?
I was expressed the desire to drive, you know, to be part of that. And since I developed such a good relationship with John Holman, you know, especially, and I just, all I had to do is ask, and they said, "Yeah, sure, we'll give you, you know, we'll give you a ride," and that's how it really happened, you know, as far as I can remember. It was nothing complicated. I would do that. I would, you know, people knew in general that I was really up for just about anything, you know, to drive, but I was, you know, always trying to hopefully go for you know, teams that are at the very top, because that's the only way that you have a chance to to score, obviously. And, you know, the experience with, you know, with Smokey was something very different. But, you know, we all know, you know, how good he was, you know, as far as preparing cars and the success that he had. Just that I turned out to be the experimental boy there. But going with Cotton Owens was a great experience. And then, you know, being able to be alongside of Fred Lorenzo, even though, you know, he wasn't volunteering any help at all, but which is fine. I mean, I was just a new boy on the block there. But nevertheless, I felt pretty good, felt confident. Ralph Moody was basically interested in being on my car. And you know, we got the car working pretty darn good, but we did not have, you know, we did not have the engines that some of the other guys had.
That's...
You know, that was a bit of a struggle for me to try to get, you know, to finally get what I deserved, I think, you know. But, you know, this story has been told many times that I had to qualify. The single qualifying was with the motor that was bound like 400 revs, and that was based on the gear that I was running. When I, the only guy that actually gave me the right tip was Donnie Allison, believe it or not. You know, I befriended the Allison brothers, you know, pretty quickly, and you know, nobody was really, you know, too open about things, but Donnie, you know, I says, you know, what sort of revs should I be pulling, you know, with a 370 gear? He says, 7,200 for sure. And I was pulling like 6,800. So when I qualified with a really low spoiler to try to get, you know, some speed out of it.
Yeah, compensate.
You know, but the thing, Lord and behold, I had to, you know, once I qualified with that spoiler, I had to race with it. And that's what really, you know, was a little bit of an issue. But honestly, even though the car was actually, you know, was loose, was very, very neutral. You know, it was very neutral, but in traffic, it was loose. It was manageable. You know, the mechanical side of the car was very balanced. So, you know, nobody can drive a car that's, you know, radically loose and you know, ready to spin. This was ready to spin, but I had the feel of the back end. Like I could almost hang out the back if, you know, sometime when I got caught out where I used to, you know, actually even, I think, at the beginning, even Chris Economaki says that he thought that I had an oil leak because I was smoking the right rear tire, you know, going into one. I don't think I turned left the entire 200 laps, you know, like I would go in a corner neutral and then counter steer, you know, to just stay in there. But I felt the back end, you know, the back end was still, you know, kind of, I had a feel for it. But I had to lead. I couldn't, you know, following, it was really tough. So I had to lead and I had to run high on the track as much as possible, you know, because I didn't want to have anyone go by me on the right side.
That must have been fun. You mean, probably you felt like you're at Winchester for 500 miles there. You know, it sounded almost more like having to hang on to a wicked beast in the dirt, but at least something you knew you could control.
I was finding where the car was the best, and quite honestly, the other thing that was leading, you know, in those days, you know, the art drafting was, you know, was really coming on, and because the cars were not as slippery as today, you know, you could draft anyone with half throttle, you know, so you save a lot of fuel. So they were fine with just keep drafting me like Pearson, Richard Petty and Yarbrough and those guys. And but I had to run high. And in those days, you know, you didn't have much front end aerodynamic downforce.
Yeah.
So not to lose the front end, you had to run just below. You know, you had to run on if you're following somebody, you had to be on this left rear corner. And that was perfect for me because it was holding the back end in, you know. And so a lot of those things, you know, I was finding out as, you know, going in the race. So I just I did what I had to do, but I had a fast car because of the low spoiler, and I took advantage of it, you know, and it worked out for me.
What did you find among your fellow drivers? You've obviously named a couple who you befriended, and I guess you could say took kindly to your presence. One of the great, and I don't mean great in a positive way, but one of the great aspects of this event for you as well is we also found that an Italian-born kid who was making his name in IndyCar wasn't necessarily the most popular person in Daytona. There wasn't the welcoming committee in every aspect of the event, from your own team and whatnot even. At least among the drivers, did you find more of them were open to work with you on the track, or at least, you know, be friendly to you in the garages? Or what was that experience like, Mario?
Well, you know, quite honestly, I didn't have any issue with the drivers. I didn't have any issue with anyone openly. I'm sure that, you know, after I won, you know, not everybody was happy about it, you know, including Ford. They wanted Lorenzo to win rather than me, you know, because I was just a one-off race, basically, for me. Or, you know, I did a couple others, but, but I never really felt like I was not welcome, because you got to remember, I mean, I was not the only one from Open Wheel there.
Yeah.
You know, Foyt, Johncock, a lot of those dudes were there. If you look at the lineup, there were three or four, you know, IndyCar drivers there competing. But after winning, they obviously didn't like that. We wouldn't have liked if one of those guys, which competed in Indianapolis, like, you know, the Allison brothers or
Cale Yarbrough.
If they would have won Indy over us, you know, so there's kind of a pride factor there. But overall, the one guy that always I felt welcome, you know, made me feel welcome, was Bill France.
Yeah.
And because I had driven the 24 hours there with Ferrari before and so on and so forth, and that's when I first met him. And then with all the testing we used to do, and he was, I had been to his office a couple of times, and he was so, so welcoming. He was such a grand individual. And that was good for me, you know. But again, overall, the motor racing world is a small family, no matter what discipline you're in. And as drivers, you try to earn the respect, of course. And, I try not to be stupid about things, you know, and creating problems. You know, I did the best I could, you know, to stay as clean as I could. And then, you know, that's all you can do. Then I think deep down, they got to respect you, you know, and that's what I was after, hopefully.
Our friend Robin Miller told me, I think he said in your bar you have one of the silly headlines after the win. It was something about Dixie Mourns Victory by Andretti or something like that.
I have that on my wall here. And
you had to wake up and see that and say, come on, really? Really, guys?
Well, that was, you know, one journalist that saw it that way. You know, but I thought it was kind of cute, actually. But but there was some of that, you know, of course.
And I believe as well, one of the other, you know, often told stories is, I don't know if you want to use the word sabotage, but, wasn't it on one of your later pit stops as well? The team might have left you up on the jacks a little bit longer to maybe see if that would help get Fred Lorenzen out first. I mean, it sounded like you were having to not only compete against the other drivers, but, you know, you're having to compete against your own team a little bit as well.
Well, actually, it was the last stop where we come in. I was leading, and Freddie was behind me, and they kept, you know, they kept me on the jacks, and, you know, and let Freddie go, and he was just about turn one already, you know, before they let me go, which I was so pissed. I mean, you can imagine, but it is what it is, you know, but then I caught him, and actually I went by, and there was a tiny Lund that actually we were lapping him, and going on the back straightaway, and you know, Freddie was right behind me then, and I couldn't shake him, and I had passed him by then, and all of a sudden, you know, Tiny motioned me to go by on the outside. He went to the center of the track on the back straightaway, and I went right up to him, and then I dove to the inside, you know, to startle things.
Yeah.
And Freddie, I think, backed off because he didn't expect that. And then I looked back, and Freddie was pretty small. He never caught me, you know. So then I just pulled away from him. And when the yellow came out with, I think, 2-3 laps to go, I was at like 22 seconds on him. So,
good Lord.
You know, I was clear of him. I just the last part when after my last stop, I drove every lap like I was qualifying.
Wow.
It was because I was so upset, you know, at that point. But once I got it clear on my own, I just drove 10 tenths, you know, and it seemed like it worked for me, you know.
Well, you led 112 of 200 laps. I have to imagine the sense of satisfaction climbing out of the car in victory lane that you had overcome more than your fair share of competition during the race, and then possibly won, you know, the biggest race of your career to that point, or one of the biggest races of your career to that point.
Oh, for sure, it was the biggest, you know, at that point, yeah.
That must have been a pretty amazing sense of accomplishment. And then a year later, obviously, Indy 500, or 2 years later, the Indy 500 blesses you with a great result. But it just really seems to me to have opened a very rich, rich vein for you in your professional career at Daytona.
But you know what I was, from a satisfaction standpoint, you know, I was a big satisfaction right after Daytona is that 2 weeks later, team with Bruce McLaren won this 12-hour Sebring, you know, and that was to me, and of course driving, you know, for Holman and Moedig again, that was a big satisfaction, you know, to do it in two different disciplines and two, you know, big races like that. You know, it was like I said. I look back, and you know, those moments. It was, you know, pretty darn good. You know, something for me to really remember forever. You know,
and that was also something where you were facing and pitted against some wonderful competition. Obviously, a bunch of great Fords. You know, with Foyt and Ruby in one of the other cars. They obviously had Porsche, which was making a pretty concerted effort there to win. You had, you know, all kinds of great competition to go up against as well. So yeah, for a relatively short time span, you had a good visit to Florida, Mario. Not too bad.
Well, you know, you look back and you know, in like 67, as you said, you know, I had a great year in Indy cars, you know. It was in pole at Indy. Obviously, you know, we had a problem. Mechanic actually had lost a wheel, I think, there. But you know, I was up for the championship until the very last race, and then, you know, I won some races on the dirt, you know, champ cars, you know, and all that. So it was, you know, it was very for me very gratifying, you know, situation to be able to you know, to run different disciplines, and also, you know, like I said, between the dirt and there was road courses and all that. So the variety was there, and we seemed to be competitive, you know, in all these different areas. So it all really played well for me, obviously, as you can imagine.
Taking everything you just mentioned, this win at Daytona, the win that followed at Sebring, the pole and positive run at Indianapolis, everything else that took place, just 67 for me comes to mind as a year that for you really spoke to the complete racing driver, the diversity of ability, where you can go down to Florida and have success there. You can go anywhere and have success in anything. Obviously, there are other drivers who would, you know, in the past, who'd jumped from different types of cars and had success. Just seems to me that 67 was really a year where folks should have seen and learned that, you know what, talent is talent, and if the person's willing and committed, you can give them a helmet and tell them what to hop into, and they can go out and deliver for you. Did you have a feeling that you were really in the middle of something rich then, across so many different racing series?
Yeah, I mean, what was satisfying, Marshall, was the fact that I had these opportunities, you know, to I just love my driving no matter what, and then opportunity to go, you know, different disciplines and be with top teams, you know, that was really, and that gave me you know, the feeling that and confidence that, you know, it's up to me now to get the job done, you know, because you know, it seemed like the equipment should be capable of bringing in some results, and that was always very encouraging, and having again these opportunities, you know, as I would mention to say to John Hallman, yeah, you know, they would accept it, you know, because they thought, oh yeah, it's worth giving them a shot. That was really, you know, it was a great feeling, you know, that people accepted me in that respect, and they felt, yeah, it's worthy of a shot, you know. So from a career standpoint, that's what you're looking for as a driver, you know, that that you're wanted, you know. And I got that clear feeling, as you say, 67 might have been, you know, one of those years where a lot of these first opportunities, you know, were there for me, and they worked out. A lot of it worked out really well.
So let's close on this. We have our friend Dario Franchitti, who was just honored and one of the honorary folks at the Rolex 24 at Daytona. You are the going to be an honorary race official for the event. Obviously, you've been to Daytona, you know, after your success in 67, so it's not like it's been 50 years. But any thoughts on what it might be like coming back 50 years after not only a great win, but one that, if it wasn't positively received by everybody back then, I have to believe every single person's going to be applauding your presence when you come back on this anniversary.
Oh, I embrace this opportunity, of course. Absolutely. It's so nice of Daytona and NASCAR to, you know, to invite me there to remember this, you know, this event 50 years ago. It meant so much to me, and it meant a lot to my career. And again, as the last time I was there for the race was for the 50th anniversary of the race, and I was invited then. And I look forward to visiting with all the drivers. You know, I follow everyone, and I have many, many friends there. You know, so I mean, even Kurt Busch, you know, right away, you know, he sent me a text. He said, "Hey, I look forward to seeing you there." Stuff like that. It's so nice, you know, that you get that. And I'll be visiting. I'll be pretty busy going around and shaking hands and seeing these guys, because you know, I look up to them. You know, I have great appreciation, and the friendship that I have to me are very precious. No question about it.
And that was the great Mario Andretti, 50 years ago, winner at NASCAR's Holy Ground, its sanctuary, the Daytona 500. Wonderful to hear that he is being embraced, and I would have to imagine will be given the honor and due that was lacking to some degree back when it took place originally in 67. Obviously, Mario, having won Formula One World Championship, won the Indy 500, won his class at 24 Hours of Le Mans, just always a true, true treasure when Mario brings his story to us. So you can catch every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast when it is fresh and new on iTunes or whatever you prefer to download your podcast through, and also put up everyone as it becomes available on our new Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page. So, as always, I'm Marshall Pruitt. Thanks for listening.